8:00. Welcome everybody. And we got a full group today, huh? And we'd like to make an announcement, and we'd like to congratulate Malcolm Drake on his campaign to become the permanent Planning Commission member on this committee. So he did it. And I also would like to congratulate Peggy, because I think she's now going to be on the Plan Commission as a non-voting member.
As an alternate.
As an alternate. So I think that's great.
She gets to vote.
Yeah, she gets to come in and do that. So I think that's another good thing to have happen. And I believe Ron Glenn was the other person that's going to be appointed as the permanent member. Yeah. So very good. Okay, at this time I'd like a roll call. Secretary call roll.
Okay. Harold.
Yep.
Malcolm.
Yep.
Gordy.
Here.
Robin.
Yes.
Bill.
Here.
Grace.
Here.
Jack.
Here.
Kit.
Yep.
Margaret.
Yep.
And Jim Frick's not here.
Oh, okay.
Yeah,
we do have a forum. Yeah.
This is Tom Toby. He's a builder. He's actually president of the Home Builders Association this year, but he's has a particular issue that's on the agenda.
Okay, great. Well, welcome here, Tom.
Thank you.
And I think he was going to be here last week, but unfortunately there were some circumstances out of your control.
Yes.
Super. Okay, first item on the agenda is the consent calendar, the May 9th monthly meeting minutes.
We don't have those done yet.
Okay, so that takes care of that. We might get out of here. Make up for last week or last month. Next item on our agenda is the Article 83, the Erosion Control Plan. And this is the one I think Gordon and Tom have some discussion on, sort of bring light. So, Gordon,
yeah,
turn it over to you.
I brought this up a couple of sessions ago, but Tom had kind of filled me in on it. It wasn't something that I personally had dealt with, and I realized about halfway into my quasi-presentation here that I was not doing a very good job of representing Tom's position. So I asked Tom if he would like to come, and then last month I had an emergency and I had to call him out. So anyway, I'd like Tom to explain what his concerns are with the county erosion control plan as a result of the subdivision. Applies to subdivisions. And
do we have a specific section that we could?
It's a section, it's Article 83, Rural Land Development Code, is erosion control and storm drain facilities.
Okay.
And under 83.020, talk about standards that shall apply to any land drain or land use application, including development and construction, which would require any grading or filling of slopes of 15% or greater for soils that are organic in compositions mapped by the Natural Resource Conservation Service, except when authorized or regulated by the Oregon Forest Practice Act. And one of the areas I'm concerned with is it's also required when you do a subdivision or a plan unit development, depending on the number of lots or the street that you're including, you need to have an engineer do the mapping and show the drainage and how they're going to capture that, how the road is going to be impacted or where the drainage is going to eventually be at the site. So that gets prepared at that time when the application is made for either a subdivision or plan unit development. At that time, as a developer, you can have each individual house site laid out on the individual lot, and usually the fee is minimal because you're already paying your engineer, soils engineer and surveyor to do this work for you. The problem with that is if the lots don't sell in a timely manner, those lots can sit there for a number of years. Somebody could come in and say, well, I like your lot, I want to purchase it, but I want to move the house to this other corner. And by doing that, you have to go back through the process again with your engineer. He doesn't necessarily have to redo all the contours and everything, but you have another fee involved to move that home site. You don't need to specify a home site. In that scenario, if another builder comes along or the homeowner, and they want to purchase that lot, in order to get the development permit, they need to go back and hire a engineer, a soil engineer, as how it's written in this Article 83, to prepare this report. And I just had another one done for another lot, and that runs almost $2,000 more to get a erosion control plan done on an acreage lot out in the county. And I'm just thinking that's almost a duplication of what the subdivision already had to have a plan once the road went in and the lots were developed, it already had to show where any water runoff from the lots was going to go. So my feeling is when I go in to develop just a single home, I guess I'm feeling it's almost a double. You know, if it wasn't prepared initially, I'm preparing it again for each lot and an additional cost to the homeowner.
What's the scope of the erosion control
plan? Well, the scope is based on the plan requirements. They have to do contours, so they have to hire either sub out or hire their own surveyors to go out and show the topography.
Right.
And then they show the proposed house site. They show the driveway in. And then usually the standards for water retention or soil migration is generally all the same. There's only a few things that I'm aware of. Every time I've done one of these, it's generally involves silt fences, rock, or things like that to avoid the movement of soils. And I guess I'm just feeling that it's a big requirement. If, you know, you've got this brand new subdivision, you have an owner come in and purchase it, and then the first thing I'm telling him was, we're looking at another $2,000 to get this house site approved, because it has to be prepared by a registered engineer. Right. Meaning that a builder such as myself or someone that's preparing the plan can't just submit a simple plot that shows the direction of drainage and how that's going to be contained in the event until things are revegetated so we don't have any soil migration problems.
Robin?
Yeah, I've got a question. Well, could it be because that maybe someone builds a house on a piece of property that may influence the drainage for the whole subdivision? Is that possible? Interfere with it somehow?
I guess anything's possible, mm-hmm. But generally it's set up. You know, water's going to always run in a downhill direction is always my argument. So I'm not understanding why, if I'm submitting something to the planning department, I can't show a proposed house. I can show the direction of drainage and show how that's going to be either contained or mitigated so we don't have issues with the neighboring properties. Mm-hmm. That why specifically this document's requirement I hire a soil engineer to do the same thing.
But then I would think that if you are you're changing the erosion pathway.
Right, but I can't change much because water's still going to go in the downhill direction, I guess. Unless I'm misunderstanding your question.
I'm just wondering if the reason why they've got it set up like that was because the water's going to run a certain way and mm-hmm. everything's going to go copacetic, but then if someone moves the house in a different location, that may disrupt what the engineer in the beginning.
That's going to be predetermined the house site. There's two options. You can either do it at time the subdivision is created,
right.
Which minimizes cost to the future purchaser of the lot, or the lots are basically just a developed lot with no approved house site, let's call it. And at that point, you do it. So it's another step, in other words.
So I'm assuming that the lot is approved. It's just a matter of movement where the house is going to be within the lot.
Right. Like I said, there's two ways to do it. If you have a six-lot subdivision, you can initially up front say the house sites, for ease of argument, they're all going to be right in the center of the property. And at that point, your engineer, who you've already hired, will take care of that. Or you just develop the lots with usually all the road approaches. Those have to be done ahead of time for the subdivision. When somebody purchases the property, then they would come out and say, well, I want to build either in the center or I want to build off to the side. You have to kind of go back through and develop that whole plan for that lot again. Like I said, the contours are already developed. They're going to show where drainage, either towards the street or towards existing drainage, is going to go. But by bringing in it, like I said, if you try to do it ahead of time, begging for people, that also can add enough extra cost because you never know if that's exactly where they want. So there's just another cost involved to move it.
Okay. Malcolm?
Hey, I'm not real clear under your first scenario. If you don't have the erosion, do they do an erosion control plan without knowing where the houses are at all, or are they postponing the whole thing?
Well, the subdivision itself will, because a lot, they have to show on the lots that are created how drainage is going to be handled, where that water is either going to impact the new street or the existing street or other lots. They'll need to show that on some
measure. I understand how they can explain or determine where the water's going to go from a house and a driveway if there's no proposal for a house and a driveway at that time. And I can see if you have a house and a driveway proposed and it's already got the erosion control figured in with the whole picture, because they're trying to look at the whole runoff for the whole subdivision and look at sizing increases that might be needed off-site, for instance, on-site. And I wonder if there's, in that situation, if there's not a way where we could say, okay, maybe if loaner, home buyer, the new buyer wants to change something on the property, it can just be grandfathered in unless it's something kind of strange, like the driveway is three times as long, or maybe the driveway.
They're not required to hand in anything extra if they're within that, whatever the building envelope was.
I'm sorry, say again? How did you guys say?
Well, we... They'll designate a building envelope, and if they're developing within that, then that's
pretty good. They're still looking at the total runoff based on the length of the driveway and the size of the house and all that stuff.
Hmm. You can't really tell.
I've never developed
one of these. Well, there's no calculations done for the amount of runoff. They're basically looking at the direction that water is going to go.
Oh.
And I'm saying that those are, that's already developed once the lot or subdivision's in, based on contours. The water's going to run one direction.
They must be doing something because they do look at having bigger culverts off-site if you're causing enough extra runoff. I don't know exactly how they calculate that. Maybe more American
law. Well, I guess the first, I know something is on the tip of Gordon's tongue. Did you want to jump in there?
Well, the only thing I would say, this is part of a larger problem as far as those of us on the builder side of things, is that over the last 10 or 15 years, more and more when we're sitting at the desk, planning department or the building department, the fallback position for them is always, well, you need to get an engineer. And, you know, that's based on the worst-case scenario, because we can all find horror stories, whether it's drainage in a subdivision that washed out a culvert or whether it's a house that slid down a hill or whatever, but always things are based on the worst-case scenario. And so even though 99 times out of 100 there would be no problem, we're all going to have to do that now because of the one time. And this is kind of the same thing. When you go in and do a subdivision, part of the subdivision is to look at the whole drainage and the sizing of the culverts and everything like that. And now you designate some home sites, and somebody, very seldom does somebody say, well, I'm going to move the home site from this corner of the property to this corner of the property. Usually it's like, well, I'm going to move it over here. And in fact, 99 times out of 100, it's not going to change the drainage in any sense, in any way. The fact is, though, because of the worst case scenario, now everybody's going to have to go and spend $2,000 with an engineer. And the engineer, because they're engineers, and this is a little bit of a sore point because I've had an engineer running me around for 2 months on a project right now. The engineer, because they don't ever want to have any liability for anything, ever, anytime, anyway, anyhow, will over-design and over-require what you're going to do. And so now you've gone from a simple situation that I wanted to move the house 100 feet to $2,000 for the engineer and $3,000 for the solution that he proposes, just to make sure that nobody's ever going to call him up and say, you know what, that culvert washed away. So as a builder, it's like, why am I having to, or my customer having to pay an extra $5,000 over a non-issue? So it would be nice, something along the lines of what Malcolm was saying, is that somehow to have some discretion there, to where if the change really is not likely to have any effect on the original drainage plan, it should be something that's a fairly simple deal. Only when somebody's moving it from here to here, or whether they doubled the length of the driveway or something, that somebody could legitimately say, well, you know, this is not the same animal anymore. Now, I understand that this is tough because somebody's got to make the judgment call. But on the other hand, the alternative is that everybody has to pay the engineer $2,000 and do a $2,000 solution when only one out of 20 of them ever had an issue to begin with. And it's cumulative. You know, it's a sore point with us because it's, and when I stand and talk to somebody at the counter, the planning guy or the building guy, he looks at me like, well, what's the big deal? Well, it wouldn't be that big a deal if it was just your requirement. But I've just come from five other people who just told me another $2,000 that I'm going to pass on to my customer because every one of them doesn't think their big deal is a big deal. And this is just one more. So I would like to see some way that somehow we can distinguish between where it really is an issue, which is legitimate. You change the situation, you change the drainage, you need to get an engineer, to the other 9 out of 10 or 19 out of 20 where that change is minimal and really should be said, yeah, go ahead.
Let me ask, is the is this a discretionary with staff? Is there something within this document that requires them to do with what they're being asked to do?
Roger, I'm going to defer to you a little bit because you've been doing this more than I have. So
I can tell you, just look at the subdivisions that everybody's seeing now. All the easy, flat, nice, perfect developable land's gone. So what we're seeing is everything's a steeper slope situation, and Malcolm can attest to it. Those are done on a case-by-case with it. I can just tell you that for all the ones I've seen, that's something that's always done. And they're in the CC&R, so they do know about it. It's not like it's all of a sudden they come in the planning department. If people are doing their due diligence, those are part of the requirements that those are called out on the plat and the CC&R. So people do know about it. It's not just...
But the way this reads, it's relating to the lot and doesn't say anything about what happens on the lot. It just says this lot has potential erosion issues, and whether you put the house here or here, that lot has to do that. And if that's already been done...
Most of the time they're not done. That's the confusion here is you have two parties here. You got the guys that are developing it that pay for the land, divvy it up, and that's as far as they go. And then you guys got guys like Gordon and Tom who come in and do individual custom lots. I haven't seen anybody at this stage that develops it out and then builds all the lots. I think Paradise Vista was, but then they ended up selling it, so you're in the same scenario. So most of the time these guys don't look at every single lot because they know people are going to change their ideas. One guy might want it here, another guy want it here. So the entire subdivisions aren't looked at lot by lot with an engineered plan for if we put the house here, we bring the driveway, here's the drainage. So basically they've just done preliminary evaluations, the roads, all that stuff can be accommodated. And then they come in, and sometimes the lots even change a little bit in size and shape. So it's all preliminary feasibility at the subdivision stage. It's when they come to actually bring a truck out, start digging and create things. Now the erosion is officially looked at because it was just an idea to show that it's going to work, everything's going to pan out, roads are going to be able to meet code. Now individual lots, they're changing that drainage. Yeah, water goes downhill, but when you change the way it goes downhill, now you're liable to that change. And so I think the code's looked at how you're changing it and are you addressing the way. So these are looked at on a lot-by-lot basis after somebody has done the groundwork to get the subdivision approved, but that's as far as they went.
If it's done lot-by-lot, it's generally more expensive. Owned a private consulting company, and we have engineers on staff that do erosion control plans, and there's a range. I mean, some of them are twice the figure you're quoted, and some are, about a $200 letter. An engineer says, I saw that, and the change is compliant with the overall erosion, doesn't do anything different. So I think there's a range, but I wanted to ask Gordon, is it really is it the threshold that you're looking at, that we do a better definition of when do we capture the 1 out of 20 that's a big deal? Is it setting the bar a little higher for what that threshold is, or do you want to see discretion in the code?
Well, maybe it's the threshold. I don't know. I guess most of the time I would think that somebody that is reasonably qualified in construction can look at something and say, well, I've blocked the drainage here, that's not going to work. The minute that you automatically go to an engineer, then you immediately accrue time and money that has to be either absorbed or passed on to the customer. And in most cases, I just don't think that's necessary. And like I said, that's become kind of the fallback for everything is hire an engineer.
You use a contractor bond going to cover things like drainage? I mean, it's not. If it's offsite drainage, let's say I'm a homeowner and Tom approves my plan and I end up affecting Robin and Robin sues me and I want to turn to somebody because I didn't design the drainage.
Well, my bond's supposed to be
a house.
Because who's going to be responsible even during construction if I don't follow the engineer's plan? I'm still going to be responsible.
But now you're writing the plan, right?
Right, but I'm just still saying the builder's going to be responsible for everything. No, it doesn't matter how many engineer stamps I get. I'm still the last person in line, first guy in the courthouse in the lawsuit. And I guess what I'm asking is not to eliminate the erosion control. I understand the we need to do that so we don't impact neighbors and things. So you don't just, you know, have a big 24-inch culvert poking right into their fence, blowing water in their backyard. But what I'm wondering is why do we, like Gordon was saying, capture a soils engineer to prepare this $2,000 document right here that shows a sediment fence and shows water heading downhill on it. To me, it just, I'm not, I mean, I understand the worst case scenario. You're on 25% slope on the side of the hill. Those things you probably do need to worry about carrying capacity and how much water is coming down and what that's going to do to the soils and all this.
I guess that's what I'm trying to capture is, do we think that there's a threshold out there that we can capture? Yes. Because, you know, when you do need to go get an engineer, and below that, contractors are going to be an acceptable drawing, or what happens at the county level? And Norm, is there somebody in Public Works that's going to review a private stormwater plan and sign off on it?
A private one?
No.
Did you say?
Erosion control plan. We're already paying $650 for tech review on it, too.
There have been isolated instances that I'm aware of where the erosion control plan, because of the conditions on site, don't technically fall within the parameters of this article, i.e., there is no significant granitic soil in the building area, nor are there slopes in excess of 15%. But the nature of the project, the county engineer felt, required some kind of erosion control plan. At least show us that you have something in mind. And so there have been instances where we have reviewed something like that that wasn't prepared by an engineer. Just to throw that out there, but that's kind of beside the point. I would like to make a couple of statements. One is, I don't know if anybody was confused as I was when I first joined the department about the significant differences between an erosion control plan and a storm drainage plan. One can be extremely involved, that being storm drainage. Erosion control can be less cumbersome to put together, and I think the costs associated with those are probably significantly different. I've always thought it would be good if the code could split those in some way to make it really clear, more so than it is here, about what is required. When we review an erosion control plan, we are, in 99% of the cases, we're talking about constructing a new road. And so we're talking about a huge impervious surface that's being created. And that is what we're really concerned about, that level of construction. What is it going to be doing to our road system, whether we take that one on as a county-maintained road or whether it is a restricted residential road or some other type of road that's going to impact something we've already got. So no, we're not really looking at individual lots at that time. Is it a buildable lot? That isn't really our determination, but as Tom said, we do require that the road approach be constructed at the same time as the road itself because it's still part of the right-of-way. And so that's something that we do require. I'm wondering if there might be an opportunity to say if there was some threshold beyond which a typical house, if you can even identify one, if a larger impervious area was going to be created because of the building design of that particular site, if it was going to go beyond what might be considered a norm or a threshold, then another erosion control plan would be required. I'm not an engineer, and everybody knows that, but I think I've seen enough of these to really be sympathetic to what's being said here. But there's got to be some way to draw a line and then know when we have to cross it.
Can I ask, are you talking about surface, roof surface areas, so like a single-story, 6,000-square-foot house is certainly going to need more drainage than a 2,002-story house? You know, smaller roof area, but impact.
Yeah, the size of the house,
the size of the like your road is an impervious surface. So
sure, and just the driveway, yeah, and anything else that might be constructed.
And that water's got to go somewhere.
Yeah, it does.
Jack had a question, and then
I was wondering, would it solve the problems? But I'm not certain that we get this wired down, because I hear Tom saying if they go through this analysis and I have an engineer present a drainage plan when they first get this done, and then I hear planning say, well, we don't pay attention to that, so maybe we're wasting the money on the first go-around. But I'm not sure that's really where the situation is. If the plan has been approved for erosion control, and they come back with a change owing to the water, where they're going to put the house, I would think there should be a procedure that if they come in with a statement from an engineer that this is not going to significantly affect the drainage plan as originally presented, waive the second analysis.
That's fairly common in a lot of jurisdictions, actually. Engineer's statement rather than a stamp plan. But you have something to go with to begin with that addresses the overall issue, and then you come in with individual. I mean, some will actually say, Clark County did this for a while, and I think Calhoun County did as well as Washington. They have an overall ordinance, and then you get an engineer's letter it's kind of the same letter as long as there's, you know, as they all match up. And then the one guy out there who wants to do something different, and guy's crazy and crazy, wants to change his entire house plan and move it somewhere else in the lot, well, his letter's going to cost a little more. But everybody gets a letter that sort of acknowledges that it needs to be the overall risk control plan. Yeah. That's what I was going to kind of get into.
Bob?
Yeah,
and then Grace?
I've seen a full range where even when we've come in with comp plan zone changes that we've had to bring in locations of dwellings and driveways just to show that it's buildable. And so, and some of them are delayed till the actual construction. Some of the things, you know, that I've seen is if it's not going to significantly increase, like, you know, increase your drainage or erosion by 20% or 10%, you know, pick a number, then a letter from an engineer saying it's not going to significantly increase it would make it a whole lot easier than having a whole brand new plan if it's not going to change it. One of the other things that I'm looking at...
Are you talking about impervious surface or actual drainage? Because then you're talking about that's a fairly sophisticated calculation, Bob. That's not going to be that easy, so...
But on the other hand, it's inexact. Now it's not around. An exact science. You know, there's a lot of slop.
Now you're just describing
all over. I've done it a lot. It's like, you can make your best guess. But what's really the 100-year rainfall rate? What's really the runoff rate, the slope, everything, and the color size? Everything about color size is different depending on the approach.
No.
One of the parts of it is, I've seen some jurisdictions where if you bring in an engineer's letter, that's the end of it. You're in Josephine County, you bring an engineer's letter, you submit it to the planning department, they schedule a tech review, which is a $650 fee. Public Works doesn't want to work on it because of the liability of trying to do things on private property. They're going to be focused on how does it impact the public facilities. So where's the review and what's the, you know, required level? Letter from the engineer saying, here's the erosion sediment control plan. And they go, okay, there's your letter. We'll put it in the file, stamp it, and it's good. Why are we doing a tech review anyway if it's, you know, based on the engineer? If it's going to be a review to see if he's accurate and well done, then why are we going through planning? Why don't we just go directly to Public Works if they want to take that on? Because, you know, from my experience in planning, we didn't have the expertise to review erosion and sediment control plans to see if it did anything. So trying to figure out how do you reduce the number of layers, decrease the cost, because we've heard it here time and time again. The Public Works says, We're only doing it because the code requires us to. And the way the code is written, it says every time you have a project in granitic soils or over 15%, you have to have the engineer's plan. Is it really that critical, and is that something that Public Works really wants to look at, or can they just look at a preliminary thing and say, it looks like it doesn't require our technical review, go right ahead?
Grace, did you have something?
I did, but I can see there's a would be helpful to have a redefinition of this from a lot of different angles, and I want to participate in that because I don't know. But I, another thing that really would confuse me is the ORS. It's on. I can see the division between storm drainage and erosion control, but also there's this very clear thing. It has to be. You need an engineer for development on slopes or granitic soils. There are actually a few pieces of property left that are relatively flat that happen to be. And I don't understand how development on those flat areas would have that much impact. In fact, the way you read this particular part of the code, anybody who builds a house, regardless of zone, if they've got granitic soils, they should have an erosion control or and storm drain, so it's real fuzzy. It's a real kind of confusing.
Jack?
I think we got the issues confused, as I understand them. Tom's beef was that he went in and initially has to do an erosion control plan produced by an engineer, pay the engineer to produce that, and get it all done. And then when he subsequently elects to sell the lot and the owner or the buyer wants to relocate the house, thereby changing the plan, then he has to go through the whole process a second time. I don't think anybody's trying to avoid the need for the erosion control plan. It's just he wants to avoid the expense to the builder on to paying it a second time when there's no good reason to do so.
Isn't that the issue? Yeah, you're close, Jack. It's not if you have a defined house site that's interpreted through Public Works for all the erosion methods. If the homeowner wants to move that site, you're not having to reinvent the whole wheel. Meaning they don't have to go out and reshoot all the topography. You just need to call the engineer and say, "I'm moving the site," and they can charge you something to reissue a new plot map at that point. The frustration with doing that is, if I don't necessarily guess where the house is going, I'm going to incur an additional cost. If I don't do anything and the lot's vacant, now you're talking almost $2,000 or more per lot to have that house site located with the appropriate erosion plan.
You've got an economy of scale if you do the whole subdivision.
If you can do it all at once,
and then you happen to pick the lots in the right spot, you've got no additional cost. You've got to move them a little bit. You might have some nominal cost.
Right,
you've divided off where you haven't done the initial work to begin with, then you've got a per lot cost that's higher.
Right. And the other issue you run into, if you try to assign them ahead of time 4 years ago, there's engineering firms that are either one no longer located here or out of business, since they're the engineer of record, when the house is completed before you guys will issue certificate of completion or occupancy, the engineer has to submit another letter saying they follow the erosion methods, slopes are erosion areas are revegetated, everything looks good. And without that letter, you're almost now you're having to go back to a different, you have to find another engineering firm to take over if they went out of business, or in the case of this subdivision, I had to bring in Reese from up in Albany because he's no longer doing work down there. He went back up north. So and the other thing I know people have mentioned, really to do this erosion plan, there is no calculation based on the size of the roof or permeable surfaces that's required, that at least that I've ever seen when I've had these done. Basically, they're showing where water is going to drain to either out to the street, if that's the low spot, or any existing drainage areas per lot. So really, like I said,
Roger mentioned too, I'm not saying it to be a smart aleck, but they're demonstrating based on the topography the water is flowing in the lowest section. It's either going to the street, it's going to an existing drainage part, and then they're showing a sediment fence or hay bales to protect that once you strip the vegetation off, so if you do get water running that direction, you're not getting it out into the street, into creeks and everything else. Right.
Any other questions?
Part of that, like I said, they're not required to do a calculation based on the size of the roof or the size of the driveway. Everybody's showing where it's going.
Are you referring to the erosion part or the storm drainage size part?
There is no storm drainage for residential lots. That's, I believe, commercial.
For the subdivision itself, though, right? I've seen storm drainage calculations depending on the cases of the planning commission where they calculate how many CFS based on how many...
Probably for a road and stuff for the subdivision when it goes in, but each individual lot do not require a storm drainage, just an erosion plan.
But you're specifically looking at the erosion. I don't see that as that big of a deal. I don't know what...
I'm learning a little bit from hearing everybody else talk, because this is something I've directly had to deal with, at least recently. But it seems to me that the erosion control plan, as done for the original subdivision, primarily has to deal with what the main road of the subdivision, the culverts, the land itself. And even at that point, the actual house, whether it's a 6,000-square-foot single-story or a 2,000-square-foot two-story, permeable, non-permeable, that's not ever even taken into consideration. What you're really looking at is what is the natural drainage, how are you changing the natural drainage, where is the water being delivered, can the culvert handle it, and so on. So then at a later date to act like the house is going to be a major change and you now have to go get an engineer, it's like, well, nobody ever really cared that much about the house before. We were concerned about what have you done to the land, what have you, how have you reshaped it, and so on. But now, that it's time to put the house in, now we're treating it like that's the tail that wags the dog, and you better go get an engineer and get a new plan. I just don't
you
see
you can have a bigger erosion control issue not putting in a driveway than you can a house. In fact, oftentimes you would.
Right. Well, yeah. I think that's more the issue. I don't know of too many houses unless somebody just collected the whole roof water into one downspout and down a granite gully where the house has really had that much of an impact. The driveway, yeah, especially if the driveway cut right across the contour that was supposed to allow them to right now. But again, it seems to me that there ought to be some simpler way to deal with that than to require everybody to go and get an engineer and draw a whole new plan, or not draw a whole new plan, but at least draw a plan, when only one out of 20 or one out of 30 or more has ever got an issue, because the drainage was all addressed at the original plan.
I guess to bring it back around, and again, this committee's charge is to say, are we looking at something that is required by state law, and are we being more restrictive in the state law? If it's not required by state law, what level do we want it to impose the kind of restrictions that we have? As I'm reading it, this is a local issue, not necessarily a state law requirement. Is my reading this right? I don't see any reference to state statute on this, but I'm assuming it's something that the county has, and each county has their own mechanism, I guess. Is this something that Josephine County feels we should, as this body, look at as something we should review and come up with some suggested language changes to accommodate, or what's your pleasure? That's sort of where I think we're heading, is in order to maintain the integrity of what we're doing, is to go Peggy and then of course.
Well, I think Kelly proposed just doing that, having for the second one, just have an engineer's letter saying, this isn't going to, they don't imagine that would cost a whole lot of money. Does anybody know what the cost or something like that would be? Because it seems like, in most cases, that would be all that's necessary. And if we could, change the language of the code saying that the letter is necessary, but if the engineer's letter says, well, actually, this is going to change it, then it may require
it. It seems to me right now, from what I'm hearing, is it's sort of a discretionary, as each application comes in, as to whether or not there's a requirement. I don't see anything here that says it has to be done.
It comes in when typically there is a subdivision done where it's been a condition of the CC&R as a prior to lot development. They demonstrate fire safety and erosion control because they're not looking at all 25 lots. They're just looking at the division as a whole.
You're saying this is a requirement of the CC&R, not a requirement of the
planning? Yeah, they're typically requirements are added in the planning phase, and typically the planning commission. They're approving the application. That is the time when all these developers are there. They have the ability to take concern with the conditions, bring it up. I've yet to see any of the developers get up there and say, we're okay with everything. We just don't want that erosion control condition. It's never been brought up. Maybe Toby and Gordon need to show up to some of these hearings, and you guys can petition the Planning Commission that the developers should stipulate the lot locations and do erosion control. I mean, that's your concern, is that it's not done at the subdivision stage, but that's their preference. That's the developer. They're not looking to individually develop. So we're always going to have that problem with, why wasn't this looked at the subdivision stage, and now I, as the individual developer, have to pick up the tab? That's because those guys aren't taking that development that far.
Is there anyone that would like, to, as a commission member, to sort of take the lead and meet with staff and Gordon and come up with a recommended language back to this committee?
I
guess
you
got voluntary
for anything.
I thought you did. I was looking right at you. You had your hand up. Falcon's right with the program. She's right with the program.
You may not get any further.
I understand you've got an economy of scale. I haven't gone through one of these either, just like Gordon. But with an economy of scale, would it make sense to just say, let's all do the erosion plan for the whole subdivision, but make it real simple to change it if somebody has to change a house that doesn't have a big impact? You say, all we need is a signature from your engineer, doesn't have for anything else. Now, I understand if the engineer's gone out of business, it's a whole different thing, but I don't know how to address that at all. Does that make sense?
Yeah, if that would eliminate that hassle, because we did a PUD back in 2005, and we identified the 6 housing lots. So far, I haven't had an issue with the ones I've built, but potentially I run the risk that client A can come in and say, you know, yeah, I see what you're talking about. That would make a good building spot, but I want to move it over here. And when I go to turn in my plot plan to the planning department, they're going to look at what's originally on file to what I'm submitting, saying they don't line up. Right. So if we add some flexibility to that.
Well, generally you do. I mean, we don't make decisions to the level of enigma in the planning department. So, you know, you move the house 6 feet, I'm going to make you do it.
Well, 6 feet, plan. I mean, right.
There is some degree of discretion. And no, it's not built into the code. And yes, it is my call. And, you know, I even meet with somebody, if you came in and said, I want to move the house, you know, 20 feet, and I'm moving it basically in the same plan with no more, you know, cut into the slope or something like that, we just pass that off. If it's on the other side of the lot, it used to be here, and now it's over here, yeah, that's something different.
Right.
And I don't have a firm number for you as to what that difference is. It's a threshold call, and we kind of work it out.
You know, I don't even think, in some of these cases, as we're Dave and I are talking right now, I don't even think that it's a necessary code change to do some of the things we're talking about right now. I don't see that it's a big issue if, and that's the big if that you guys are bringing up, if these houses, these lots already have an erosion control plan and they're changing it slightly or greatly, whatever, that's going to be determined by an engineer. I don't think that's the planning department. You know, David's got the ability as a policy that we could, in lieu of, you know, past practices, we got to go get a brand new erosion control plan. That if we get a letter from the engineer saying these changes aren't that significant, blah, 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 I don't think we need to necessarily change the code to do that. But the issue that I think that I'm hearing with Gordon and Tom is that just doing them in general, that they're not done at the subdivision stage. And that, like I said, that's a personal preference by the developers, and that's their choice. So that one we're not going to be able to solve without a complete change of the code in some way, shape, or form. And how far do you want to go or not go with ensuring, you know, quality development, and we're putting together things where, you know, all of a sudden all the neighbors are complaining that everybody's lots are draining across everybody, and, you know, everybody's upset, and why did this get approved? So there's going to be that level of, at what point do you want to just not do anything and buyer beware and have at it and we don't do anything? But in the meantime, cases where there already are engineered plans, storm drainage, I don't see it policy-wise. We couldn't look at Tom or Gordy comes in, the guy wants to move it across the site. Well, if the engineer sends a letter to us, says it's not going to change, I don't see that that's a problem that we can't address internally right now.
That's the kind of thing that I would ask for. Mm-hmm. If you wanted to move it across the lot, I've seen a letter.
So this would be a policy.
The cost of water probably the same as the cost of them redrafting a CAD document.
So do we all agree that this sort of is a policy issue and should be dealt with at the director's level rather than creation of a change in ordinance? I see everybody going.
Actually, I don't think the code gives you that flexibility. It says a plan, any grading or filling, it is required a plan by a registered civil engineer. It doesn't say a letter.
Well, this is where I would get at. I think there's two issues, Harold. There's the having to do it in general, like Grace is talking about, and then there's the issue of we've already had some kind of plan and we're changing it. The customer wants it differently than the other guy that paid for the original plan. Now I got to do a new one. Those are the cases where I think policy-wise we can say, look, we get a letter from the engineer, it says the changes are nil, great. That, Grace, this is a different issue. So there's two issues here. You don't have one ever, and you got a pre-existing one, but there's changes. So I think those are the ones that I think we can deal with at staff level right now without changing the code, policy-wise, are the ones where there's already an existing one, there's just changes, whether they're minor or major, we'll just leave that to the engineer to say it is or isn't, and the letter suffices for us. It's the situations where there's nothing is, I guess, where the group needs to decide how much or how little should be involved there to deal with these things or potential problems that come of it. Jack?
Maybe we could make a recommendation to the board and to the planning commission that the planning department be specifically granted discretion to waive the need for a second engineering report where paid by an engineer indicated that there's no significant change to be affected by the proposed change in plan.
I've already got that for the ones where they did a complete plan.
Well, as Roger said, that kind of solves one part of the equation. Right. The other part is, I'm not an erosion control engineer or expert, neither is Roger, and we got a brand new lot out there with no existing plan on it.
Well,
and somebody comes in and
knocks us to see their plan. An overall subdivision plan. And there's just a minor change.
Okay.
So am I, let me see if I'm following everything correctly. We've got somebody who comes in and creates a subdivision and gets the map, and then builders come in and buy up the lots. Well, the guy who did the subdivision, he's trying to minimize his costs and maximize his profits, right?
Generally speaking, yes.
Yeah, so he's going to do as little as possible, right? To get sellable lots.
It's a paper development.
Yeah. So
but can
he's
get that?
Do the
can
absolute
get that
minimum
that
he can. Correct.
He still had to have done an erosion control plan for the whole subdivision.
Okay.
He can't do any less than that. And my point is that takes care of 95% of the issue right there.
Okay.
So if you come in and he does that, he does the minimum, and he wants to get through the planning commission, and the planning commission says, well, we think you should have erosion control plans, he's going to go, whatever, sure, what do I sign? Because he knows he's not going to pay for it. He's going to sell a lot. Tom's going to pay for it. But the fact is now Tom, 2 years later, wants to build that house, and nothing's really changed from the original overall plan, but he's now required, because there either wasn't a house site designated or because he wants to move it from where it was designated, although it probably wasn't designated, he has to do another plan, even though it really isn't necessary, usually. Now, the house is one thing, the driveway is another. Most of the problems are going to be created by the driveway. And that's the one where I'm caught in the middle here, because
a driveway, if it's non-permeable, it collects a lot of water, it dumps it into a ditch, and it delivers a whole water supply somewhere. Now, if it's done properly, it delivers it to a county-approved ditch and a county-approved culvert, and it goes somewhere good. But to have to do a whole new plan of the whole site because you're now building a house. But I guess what I'm not clear on, when Roger is saying something that has no plan, are we talking about an individual lot that's sitting by itself or is a part of a subdivision or something?
No, we're talking, say...
Are we talking about a lot in a subdivision that has a plan, but it doesn't have an individual lot plan?
Exactly. They didn't actually do the engineering to show on lot 5, we're going to put the house here, the driveway is going to come down, and there's your erosion control plan to address it. Basically, they'll put a square, 100 by 100, just to show, look, we can fit a house in there and meet setbacks. That's as far as they go. And most times, they don't even put that if they're big enough, because a lot of these guys don't want to be bound to a specific, because that's what you come out of with the Planning Commission decision at designating and doing all these individual lots, is now you've approved all these to be at these locations. And a guy now says, but I like the house back here. Well, that's where that lot was approved. Some of those can be specific like that. But I've seen that. Blackwater PUD is a prime example of that. All those lots have a specific home size.
Right.
They have to be built. That was designated at the Planning Commission level. Approved, subject to. And so those guys are held to it. Where you guys are talking about are the situations where it's just a 5-acre lot, have at it, but just address where you're putting it with an erosion control plan to address how you're developing. So that's where it's not getting looked at.
Grace?
Well, how do you distinguish if someone does a subdivision 10, 15 years ago? And typically, as I recall, for someone who wants to build a house in rural residential, they have to, if they're going to put in a driveway, maybe there was a plan 15 years ago, but typically planning has just required to show that the driveway can accommodate emergency vehicles if it's built on a slope. So how would the planning department actually, what would trigger that review if it's granitic soils and, I prefer the and rather than or, granitic soils, what would trigger planning saying, oh, okay, before we're going to give you a development permit to build that house, not only do you have to establish and demonstrate that emergency vehicles have access, but that you're not going to create an erosion. And
that's in Article 76. That calls out. This talks about it in general. Article 76 talks about the fire safety development, but also there's a reference to granitic and steep slopes and erosion control requirements.
Well, I think maybe seeing as how we're the ones that threw this thing on here and we've had some good discussion, but it's gone on for almost an hour, I think maybe it's back to us to come back with some kind of a proposal, either just an understanding that everybody's on the same page, or else some language to add, or whatever. Because I don't think we're that far away from, in most cases, achieving what we both want, is to make sure that we don't create some major problem, but at the same time, we try and find a way so that in most cases there are no-brainers. We don't have to spend $2,000 in the engineer to drive by and go, yeah, it looks pretty good. Here's your pitfall.
You're always going to find an engineer that will do that.
So I'm hearing you volunteer as a one-person task force to provide some recommendation to this committee in relationship to... Thank you for it. Thank you.
Steph, we'll meet with the one folks in
that. Yeah.
We'll try to keep them on.
And get back to us.
And sidebar with Tom.
Two months. 2 months, okay.
Gordon, if there's a jurisdiction,
you
think addressing the issue better than we're doing it. You know, we get that all the time when we're out of COVID, so we have another jurisdiction. If they're doing it right,
we can talk to
the people. Is there anyone else that would like to participate with Gordon? Congratulations, Gordon.
Okay.
Okay, so we've sort of cleared that up a little bit, yeah. Okay, so let's move. We'll hear something back in September then. Work out September.
Okay. Thank you for your time. I appreciate it. August
meeting? Yeah, we have August meeting. I gave him 2 months. Or no, a month, a little month. Okay, next one is a procedural plan for recommendation to BCC, Jack Swift. That was good.
And what I can do is give kind of an update of what's gone down. A week ago Wednesday, there was rather a exciting meeting of the Board of County Commissioners that led to a lot of discussion around town. Fortunately, before that fiasco and rodeo got away, I was able to go before the commissioners and request that they forward the recommendations from our committee to the Planning Commission for the Planning Commission's review and recommendation, and request that the Planning Commission address the issue as expeditiously as possible. And so that was received by the board. At this point, I don't know what they might have done with it, but because
they didn't vote, I guess. Huh? They didn't vote on it.
Well, they couldn't then. They will have to undertake the administrative decision to go ahead and forward that. And hopefully it will go forward.
Just to follow up, I had met with them. I was at their July 5th meeting, I think it was, and specifically to ask where we were in regards to the letter that we sent in regards to the planning staffing this meeting and any financial, along with the other recommendations. And I think Dwight was going to get with David, and I thought maybe he could give us an update when he gets to his report. But my impression was that they weren't prepared to move forward on at least to July 5th, that they were thinking that I'm not sure they felt that they could send it to the Planning Commission at that point in time. I'm not sure what the confusion was, but I was a little concerned that it just seemed to be laying there at the board level. I don't know whether it finally got to Dave or not, but they did assure, at least Dwight did, that you'd have staff here, which we have. One of the commissioners was wondering whether or not we could just go ahead and utilize one of ourselves as the recording secretary and keep the minutes and things like that, but I think it's working okay at this point. There is no money as far as if we needed money for copies or outside costs. Those things have not been included in any budget at this point, but I think the staffs have been included in the budget from the standpoint of economic development. I expect you can give us a report at some point. But anyway, I didn't get as clear a picture at that point in time that they were going to move those documents forward. So,
well, having made the initial petition, I could send an email to the commissioners and make inquiry of what are you going to do about our petition that I presented.
See, we submitted that on June 14th, I believe, so it's been about over a month now. This one, I hand-delivered the recommendations to the commissioner's office.
Well, when I did it, they said they had, or Commissioner Hare said that they had the package on the material, but hadn't addressed them yet.
Okay, yeah.
I'll send a follow-up email. Make inquiry.
Well, let's hear from Let's hear from Dave on his report and see where we are, and then I would agree that if we haven't moved, then we need to probably send something from the committee. Dave?
There might be a little confusion as to what was presented. I hear you guys talking about an issue, but you might be talking about two different things. You're talking about the letter that went from LDAC as a whole that you signed and hand-delivered to the commission, correct?
Yes, along with, and also two things, was the packet of recommendations.
Okay. And then, Jack, were you talking about this draft that went to the board on June 29th? That was what was forwarded to me.
I've never seen this one.
That's
is this the one you put it? Oh, okay.
And that was the draft.
Yeah. Okay, that's the one we asked you to put together.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. So there's this, but also in that packet of recommendations, which are the public roads, and then the. 76, the Deer Winter Range, and the public roads. And I think this is just addressing the Deer Winter Range.
Also, but that kind of fallen on the
Okay.
3615 died.
Yeah.
Well, this is. That was going directly from LDAC to the board, and
that's the one issue, and then there's also still what are they doing with the public roads issue and the Article 76.
And Deer Winter.
Yeah, well, that's what this is. This is your winter range. Yeah, I remember that now. Specifically.
29th makes more sense than the 14th.
Well, you did, yeah, we did the 29th, but then we also did before that was the 14th, is where I submitted that.
You submitted it.
Mm-hmm. After we got the minutes from the meeting. So
we had a couple of different things coming to staff, and I didn't know where this came from. It went directly to the board in a order format.
That was my request, a board order.
Okay. To provide them a draft.
To review the recommendations and make their own recommendations.
Yeah.
All right.
Yeah. Which would either go to the Planning Commission and the Planning Commission back to the board.
Report from the planning director. So, I mentioned to you before that I had some concerns about how we were going to go after whatever changes that this committee recommends. And one of the things that I put together, and I just made a copy for Harold, because I didn't finish it till this afternoon, but I could. From the date of the last comp plan general update, which was August of 2006, the last codified version was in 1985, and the changes to the plan policies are regarding wildlife and ag resources and natural resources and housing and amending the comp plan criteria and population forecast procedures, and there's about 10 items of just general comp plan updates that have happened. And then since the date of the last RLDC update, which is in October of 2005, the number of ordinances that changed the text of the RLDC were 10 ordinances, and I think I've got 19 different portions of the code. So right now, what we're working with, the working draft you have is the 2005 version with 19 changes already. And we've got a few things that are on the Planning Commission docket already, home occupations, and then look at some other things regarding business retention and incentives and that sort of thing. And then what other work that your group does. And my concern is that we're adding complexity in our search for simplicity. That's my final statement here. I did that for tax benefit. Due to the number of changes made to the comp plan and RLDC in the past 6 years, prospective changes either approved by the Planning Commission or currently be developed, and the breadth of issues now being addressed by LDAC, there may simply be too much on the table for a large-scale code text change to be well understood. My suggestion to LDAC and the Planning Commission is to codify the current code, the May 2005 version, with the existing amendments. Start with a clean copy before adding future changes. While the scope of codifying the code is not yet budgeted, the potential for working through prior amendments while adding at the same time new ones presents the potential for adding complications. So I guess my problem is that we've got a code that's got all these changes with it already. Now we're going to make more changes. That's going to get real complex.
We never should have started.
What's that? We should have started with a clean code.
Well, the thing is,
those amendments
are already in this copy that we have.
What's that?
Didn't you say the amendments that have been made since
2005
are already in this copy?
But they're not. That's what we suggested. No. They haven't been actually accepted by the board and integrated. No.
Oh. Well, they're accepted, but they didn't have the right hardware to put into the paperwork or something.
Yeah. I mean, there's.
So again,
what you inherited is a complexity of it. This document is complex in that it's got what's codified, what's passed, what's adopted. It's got changes in it that have been adopted. It's got references to other documents. And now we're going to change all of that. And I'm concerned about complexity in that.
Again, the whole charge of this committee was to basically review our existing ordinance and address those and see if those are our local ordinances are more excessive than the state law. And if target.
I'm pointing to implementation and how do we get there.
In my mind, the decision to be made by the Board of Commissioners after hearing from the planning department and after review by the planning commission. And if what I hear David proposing is we're going to do this rework of the house, and we've already got on the table that we're going to completely redo the kitchen. We don't want to undertake to do the bathroom at the same time because that would be just too much work. I don't have much sympathy with that position. But the Board of Commissioners might. And the Board of Commissioners might think that the proposals that we've brought forward are foolish and they don't want anything to do with them. I think all we can do is make the proposals. The argument as to whether they are too tedious to undertake should be made to the commissioners.
No, I'm not talking about the tediousness of your proposal. I'm talking about do we do this all at once or in a couple of steps? And I'm recommending a couple of steps.
But I think that...
Well, that's eventually where it would go. But I'm, I don't want to blindside you guys. That's that's where I'm coming from.
Thank you. Appreciate
you asked for a planning update. That's going to
be a half step back to confess my own ignorance and ask what does codified mean, and what you mentioned several different terms, codified, and what does all that mean? Is that it aren't codified yet? Is that your definition?
Okay. A codified version is a final clean copy of whatever you've adopted.
I see. But these changes have been adopted. They just haven't been finally
You're looking at a document, but there's a bunch of other documents that it makes reference to that you have to read at the same time, and that's what makes it real difficult to follow the balance of the law.
So 19 doesn't seem to me like a really exponential number here.
We're going to sit on the planning commission.
Maybe a half dozen recommendations. He doesn't seem like that would be overwhelming to add that to the 19, but maybe I just don't understand.
Well, you're an alternate. You'll be seeing it.
Yeah.
Great. I'm not sure what the breadth of your changes will be, though. I mean, last meeting we had, it sounded like you wanted to look at the whole code and you were looking at some fairly broad changes. Margaret, and I looked at some of the proposals that you made in your changes to the last
time
you were looking at the code. And
I was just, there weren't any proposals.
I don't know how big the bread basket
was. I was just looking at, at where I found what seemed to be discrepancies, right. And I don't think there were any actual proposals around that. The half dozen I was referring to is the things like Deer Winter Range and there are 76 of roads and things like that. And I was just wondering if you're suggesting that those all be taken off the table at this point? Or?
No, I think if that's the limit of the scope, maybe we can add them to the 19 and make sense of this thing and codify it, and it's good to go. But if we go beyond that, then I am concerned.
I understand. Thank you.
Okay.
Grace, and then Kit.
Oh, I just wanted to have you clarify what you just said. So basically, did you say that, the changes that were introduced in 05 and are not part of the printed copy or the CD or whatever, that's going to be done first, and then when the 19 that the planning department is working on will be added later, and then reintroduced into it, assuming they're accepted, and then possibly adding whatever number that this committee, a third, I'm thinking of, is that what you're saying, A, and B, if you are saying that, that's still a lot of expenses.
2005 is done. The 19 changes that have happened since 2005 are referenced in your working draft or included in your working draft. There are also some things in there that are suggested that are not in the ordinance, so we have to weed out the stuff that didn't actually pass. That's one clean copy with 19 changes. maybe adding bare winter range as a few of the things that the committee here has worked on. But if the number gets much bigger than that, this gets to be real complicated.
So are you saying those 19 changes have been approved already by the board?
No.
Integrated into
they have not.
Okay.
No. This working draft incorporates the old code,
right,
plus suggested proposed changes. A few of them have been adopted in our ordinances now. The majority of them have not been before the Planning Commission, who has to review them. Then it goes by ordinance to the board to be adopted. Each change has to be done that way.
But you've got, on my list, I do have 19 things that were changed in order.
And then you have to take into account that I myself worked on the changes for all the OARs and the stats up to 2008.
Mm-hmm.
And that is a line by line by line, each and every page of that document. 2009, 2010, and new laws for 2011 are not even done.
So, this in our document here, you have the blue pages, which
mm-hmm.
Mike put in here,
yes,
some of the things that have already been.
These were his proposals.
Number one has been sort of, he says, finished projects, revised
mm-hmm.
code only.
Right.
And then you have mandatory changes and stuff.
Right.
Right. Should have
so, the little blue thing is your outline as to what we still have to do, and it falls to David and me. So the yellow pages were Michael's somewhere. He took them and rewrote a lot of the majority of that section so that he felt it was easier to understand if he just took the whole section and put it in yellow rather than inserting this and that. Not all of them, not having looked at, no. See, this working copy, a lot of it in there has not been before the Planning Commission and been accepted and adopted. That's what we're working off of. These were, a lot of this is proposed. There were three ordinances in 2006 that were adopted. There is an ordinance on those, and they are not in the 2005 copy as yet. They're like a supplement. So everything we've done since 2005 that is an ordinance that has been adopted by the board is as a supplement to that, but it's not incorporated within. And then there have been other changes since then that have changed some of the ordinances that are supplements that are still not into the draft.
Let me address Article 76.
Yes.
We were looking at the yellow enough, should we have been looking at the white stuff all the time?
Probably.
Okay. Now that we're really confused.
Does that clear some of that up?
I guess
the last year and a half for no reason.
No.
I think it's going to be important, though, that at least the work that we've done to this point and submitted to the board needs to be addressed by the board, and that hasn't been done yet. They have not met with the planning director to go over what we submitted and then get some kind of, either give some kind of direction to proceed and prepare it for the Planning Commission or bag.
Just ground the committee.
Yeah. Well, or just bag what we've done and say we're not gonna move forward with it. But I think that's gotta be the next step, and based upon the fact of what we've heard, that hasn't happened yet. They haven't had any discussion with you on that. So I think it would be appropriate for us to send that email to the board asking that they meet with the planning director, and they may want us there. They may want the committee or some member of the committee there to go through some of this if that's the case, but we need to make ourselves available if, in fact, that's necessary. Now, what we didn't do, based upon the original order, was have a joint meeting with the Planning Commission and the Board of County Commissioners. That was to make the presentation, but we didn't, and I talked with Sandy on that, and she said it wasn't necessary to do that. It was just to submit the proposal to the board. So we didn't follow the exact
order. Have kind of a round table discussion between Harold and Dwight and myself and Sandy. I think we all agreed that
so,
a joint meeting between the PC and the board would just be
So that's what we need to do now, I think, is to put a fire under the board, I guess, and say we'd like to get a response or some action on these items as soon as possible. Is that everybody in the committee sort of feel that way?
I don't know.
Gordon,
well, then, I just like a clarification. Like on this list here of 19 or whatever, choosing, for instance, the deer winter range overlay. When we were having our whole discussion, which went on over 3 or 4 meetings of deer winter range, we were discussing what we understood to be the code as it exists,
mm-hmm.
and what we thought the problems were and where it ought to go. Were we missing a piece there, that there was already something in the works that was not being thrown on the table and saying, well, you guys should discuss this, but there's already some changes there, isn't there?
I don't think there was.
No,
the
no, you didn't indicate a conflict with what we've done. What we indicated was just the burden of incorporating what we've done and potentially what we might have done.
Okay. You need to pass that around. That's the only one they have.
Oh, I love doodling all over.
Sign your doodles. That may be worth something someday.
Sorry. That was funny.
Great.
Writing erosion control plan.
Well, Dave brought up a point that I think we need to address. Because if I recall correctly, which at this stage I may not have recalled correctly, that we did vote last meeting to go through the code and make changes on a chapter by chapter basis, which for the record I voted against, and I voted for. So it sounds like we've sort of abandoned that, but we haven't made it official. I still don't think that we're capable of doing that or that we should do that, but I think we should discuss it here. And are we going to go forward with that idea?
I think it's
proposal or not.
I think it's important to find out just what the board's going to do on what we've done. If in fact they decide that this is not, they're not going to do anything, or it's going to be, then our recommendation would be to discontinue the committee. Because there's no sense if they're not going to take what we've done and move it through the process, at least for consideration and public involvement, then I think we're spinning our wheels.
That's true.
I
may not make a decision for several months, and we're working away on it.
Well, but I think if we at least ask for and put a timeline on at least a meeting, there needs to be a meeting between the Board of Commissioners and the planning directors so they can get a feel from, and the Public Works, to get a feel for where does the staff at on this in regards to the timing and what they need to be done and move it forward. And I think we or some members of the committee ought to be at that meeting to provide some input. And it would be probably good to have a particular chair from each of the task force there so they could relate to the activity that's been put into this. Peggy?
Would it make sense to, at this point, push to get the board commissioners to review it? We don't want to open up the floodgates and have the possibility of washing out all the work that's already been done in the flood of possibly. So I think it is important to get the stuff that we have already done.
Okay.
It seemed to me from the last meeting there was a question as to whether the Board of Commissioners would budget for contingency. So I would think that maybe we ought to call a sabbatical for the committee pending decision by the Board of County Commissioners after the meeting.
At my July 5th meeting, Dwight, after discussion on staffing and or money, and there is no money, there is no actual dollars budgeted for outside type of activities that we needed anything, and we hadn't spent that much money anyway on like copies or whatever. My impression was, the discussion was that Dwight was, and the board sort of had agreed that he would go to the planning director and say, go ahead and provide the staffing and the advertising for the public meeting for the committee. And that was where, that's the last I've heard, was that Dwight was going to get in touch with David as the liaison and indicate that the board was okay with providing the secretarial minute taking and providing a staff person, one of the staff, David or Roger or James, to the meeting, the staff if they need the board and Public Works, but and that was paid for by, they were saying that they're already providing money through economic development, and that's how the staffing would be covered. That's what I heard out of that discussion. And so I don't know whether Dwight has talked to...
I haven't got any specific direction.
And that was back on July 5th.
Okay.
So I think it's appropriate to do an email request on behalf of the committee.
The meeting occurs to me that you and Malcolm pick a third person to...
Well, I think it's appropriate.
I think Malcolm would be important as being the planning commission and the rep.
Yeah. But the protocol would be to meet with the chairman. And that's my belief. And unfortunately, the chairman does not want to work with me, so it would be somebody other than me.
That sounds...
But
I'll send an email to the commissioners and request that we have a hearing with somebody based on you as our chairman, Malcolm as representative from the...
Well, no, we're asking. No, Jack, we're asking them to start the process by meeting with the planning director to go over the recommendations that we have provided them. At this point, i.e., the public, the roads. You've already got the mechanism moving as far as the Deer Winter Range, but the other one is Article 76, and so that's. But they haven't met with him at all at this point. And it looks like all he got was this document,
right,
with no meeting. So. But I would say, meet with the planning director and include...
That they consult with the planning director.
And include...
And we'll volunteer if they want to discuss it.
Members of the committee.
We can send
members of the
yourself
committee.
And Malcolm.
Okay. That sound fair enough to this committee?
We just need to light a fire in it, right?
Yeah, and like I say, if nothing's happened between now and the next meeting, which is what, next week?
I don't feel that.
Which makes me
happy.
You're back to that. When we pay attention.
So I think it would be important for us to meet in August.
Okay.
Now, we've already got Tom and Gordon coming.
Yeah, they're coming back. No, they're coming back in September.
2 months.
But I think if something hasn't happened between now and the August meeting, then we'll meet. And if it's determined that, then I think we need to decide where we should be going as a committee. So that would be my impression.
Now, where is this meeting going to take place between which commissioners and you and me?
Well, we don't know at this point. But I think the email, Jack, you need to make sure we all get a copy of it, is to, again, meet with the planning. They meet once a month. You had one already.
Isn't their executive or business session or something?
No. This is, they usually have monthly updates, so they could call him in on an administrative meeting.
We're special meeting.
Getting creative about my schedule.
I'm just giving you opportunity.
That's what they're. I do a planning update with the board that's now scheduled for twice a month, second and fourth Tuesdays.
That's the one over. I think that's the one they have. The one they have over. Is that the one they have over at the ambassador? Is that the one they have over there?
I'll be at the ambassador.
So,
could I request that they send this out by email?
He was going to, I think. Yeah.
I just got notice that.
Well, I think it would be at the next planning director's update or whatever you call those.
Well, we'll just send the firecracker in.
Yeah.
And then, David, you can always ask them if they had received it and reviewed it, and you were expecting to hear about
lighting
it.
Lighting the firecracker.
I think we should. Bring a box of matches.
You know, somebody's
got to
take
it. That's right.
So the final decision on that was that Jack will send the email, the board will contact David, and there will be a meeting, and they'll decide at that meeting how to proceed
with the recommendations.
Okay.
And that we're hoping that some kind of determination has been made between now and our next meeting.
Okay.
That action would happen.
And we will volunteer questions.
Okay.
Or representative group from our committee to meet with them and explain the proposals.
That's
pretty
simple.
Is what?
Our recommendations were pretty straightforward and simple.
Yeah.
They were common sense recommendations.
That's true. Any more report from the planning director? That was sort of a nut, wasn't it? Okay, matters from committee members. We don't have any subcommittees at this point in time, other than what Margaret has done with her work, but we're going to put that on hold until we hear what's going on as far as I've been reading all this. Any other matters?
So the fact that there's no funding means that our field trip to see how they do planning in Bermuda is
Sorry. Yeah. I'd already contacted the cruise ship, Just before Bob had his hand up, but I just wanted to show you, I ran across the general plan for the Josephine County urbanizing area and the city of Grants Pass. This goes back into 1976. That's Josephine County as to how they had the official map. Do you remember that, Bob?
Okay. No, it's not upside down. That's right. Yeah.
But that's what was in place before LCDC came along.
Mm-hmm.
And on the back of it, there's all of the...
1976.
Huh?
Did you say 1976?
I can't remember. It's earlier than that, yeah.
LCDC was...
Yeah, no, it was. This was before we had to come up. This is the plan we already had in place. And then on here it talks about the goals and objectives, the land use, public facilities, and I mean the home area. But it's
too long.
It is. Well, it's sort of crummy colors too.
Definitely.
Yeah. And that was given to the LCDC at the time too. Anyway, Bob, Bob, you had something.
Yeah, I've got something. DLCD, under the guise of housekeeping, has OAR changes to the forest rules, OAR 660-006. And what it said is every jurisdiction has to identify forest land by using the NRCS maps, which is very similar to the BSCS maps, but now it's electronic format. And it has to be identified in cubic feet per acre per year.
Mm-hmm.
And with that, it pretty much makes a real mess of how do we deal with things because our IRR system doesn't really apply anymore. Except our code still requires us to apply the IRR system, so we have double reviews of things, because I've had a couple of complaints that were in process that have gone to hearing, and I've had to address the new OARs as well as address the IRR system. One of the things that has come out of that whole issue is similar, and the reason I bring it up is because even though it says you've got to say how many cubic feet per acre per year by each soil type, it doesn't say what the threshold is to identify what forest land where it starts. And there's a lot of different ideas and a lot of different thoughts of where is that threshold. And the way LUBA has looked at it is the way the state did with urbanization. They said clearly 10 acres and larger is clearly rural, it's not urban. Anything 10,000 square feet is clearly urban. But we don't have a definition of anything in between. It just says if you do anything less than 10 acres in size, you have to address Goal 14, the urbanization goal. They did the same thing to us on this forestry thing, saying you have to identify everything by cubic feet per acre per year, but it doesn't say, is it 5 feet is forestry, 10 feet, 20 feet, 30 feet, 40 feet, 50 cubic feet per acre per year? It doesn't address it. I had some conversations in things with Roger, and I've gone through a lot of different things. And the problem that I have is a lot of people have picked 20 cubic feet per acre per year as the threshold of what's commercial forestry and what isn't. The foresters that I've worked with say, no, that's too low a bar to set, that nobody would consider things using 20 cubic feet as the threshold for forestry, commercial forestry use. Josephine County needs to take a policy decision of where they establish that, whether it's on a case-by-case basis or a hard number, that this is something that's going to have to be looked at. Because the Luba cases that I heard and read, it said clearly below 20 cubic feet is clearly not forest land. Clearly everything above 80 cubic feet per acre is not, or is forest land. But we don't know all that stuff between 20 and 80, which is a pretty big spread. And then when you start looking at things, because we've had some things that we've looked at, like when you're putting houses on property through the template test, they go based on the cubic feet per acre of the soil. But here's some things here, just trying to show the difference between what our system was and what the state system is. Because the IRR system, here's the one at 3.03, clearly below the 3.5. It falls in the cubic feet per acre per year of between 50 and 84. Here's another one, 3.23, which is clearly below the 3.5. It's above 85 cubic feet per acre per year. Here's a 2.99. It says it's between 50 and 84. So just about all that stuff that you're talking about with IRRs of less than 3 or less than 3.5 is clearly going to be classified as forest land. When you look at the differences in the systems, there's the old thing that said site class or site index, and that's how big a tree is supposed to be at 100 years. And when you look at the things there, a site index starting at 100 is at about 83 to 84 cubic feet per acre per year is a class 4 site index of 100. When you start looking at those curves, a lot of them don't even start until you get to 50 cubic feet per acre on a site index. And if we put the bar down at 20, just about everything under the sun is going to qualify. And the other thing is when you look at 20 cubic feet per acre per year and you look at economy of scale, is that may work over in eastern Oregon that you're going to harvest on lands that are 20 cubic feet per acre, but you've got ownerships of 2,000 or 3,000 acres and you're going to find some clusters and it may be economical to buy those big pieces. But over here, if you've got 25 cubic feet per acre and you've got a 40-acre chunk, you're not going to make any money on that. So where is the threshold going to be for Josephine County on cubic feet per acre relative to what's commercial forest land and what is not? And so I would say, well, we need a subcommittee if that's something. or we at least need to ask the board, are they going to establish a policy or are they going to just say, well, we're not going to establish anything and every property owner that wants to do something, they're going to have to prove it on a case-by-case basis and you get no help or no guidance from us of what we're going to accept or what we're not. And is the county going to change the IRR system and say, okay, if you have your cubic feet, then you don't need to deal with IRR. It's a real mix and match of where things are and what we're going to have to do to try and make sense out of the system. So I'm just bringing this up to the committee of, is this something...
I can see that on David's list.
Okay.
Changed to.
Oh, that was number 20. Did you get that? Did you get the memo? This is a real screwed up mess, and it's
going to get worse.
Yeah,
I
told you I couldn't afford it. First of all,
Bob, now you want
to know. Yeah, now I'm going to throw something as simple as this in, and I know other jurisdictions have dealt with it. I know Jackson County, they established 20 cubic feet. I think they were foolish to do it, but I know they were getting pushed by special interest groups, and they just figured in 20 and just walk away from it because we're not willing to try and deal with the fallout of trying to make sense out of it.
I'm sorry, Bob. It wasn't on David's list of things to do, so it'll have to wait until next year.
Okay. Now,
a little clarification, but 2001, the State Department of Forestry pushed against Jackson County above 20 cubic feet. But honestly, from what the stuff they're reporting on that last hearing we had at the Planning Commission last Monday, which anybody who's worked with soil or aerial photos could see that was serpentine soil at a glance. And I believe it was showing 18 cubic foot per
17.
Per year. 17? Well, I'll tell you what, that wouldn't be commercial forestry to me. Anything that's serpentine is not likely to be commercial forestry.
Malcolm, that's a continued hearing.
Pardon me?
That's a continued hearing. We're talking about...
I'm not talking about the hearing last Monday. I'm talking about in general.
There you go.
I mentioned a disagreement that was going on between these two guys. About whether that is defined by the state or not. Do you remember, there's been a conversation about Luba said it was 20, Bob saying it's not set. Like, is it really not set? Or is it?
No, Bob's right. I was confusing something with another definition when I got back to the office, but Bob's absolutely right. There is no set number. Stipulate one. We don't have one. He's right about Jackson County. That's where they've established theirs. We just took the stance that given what Jackson County looks at, and if you look at, it's mentioned in the statutes and the rules. In other words, the non-farm dwelling talks about not only the quality of the farm soils, but then it gets into the forest productivity. 20 cubic yard or cubic foot per acre, Eastern Oregon, or 50 Western Oregon. Western Oregon, to me, means they're talking Willamette Coast. So, given that's kind of the only areas I've seen it discussed, like Bob said, we just got hit with these rules at the beginning of this year that we have to apply. The IRR essentially is history, unless we do a complete remake of it. So, I think staff, for any argument's sake with any opposition, because honestly the ones you've all seen have been under 20 cubic foot, so it was a safe number given what there is talk about in the statute, what Jackson County goes by, and the fact that all the projects we've seen so far are less than 20. But the reality is, because we were on the IRR for so long, we've never had to come up with this number. But what Bob's getting at is, at some point we do need a definitive number, because not every single one is probably going to go under 20, and we got to figure out where Josephine County fits with that so distinction of what makes it.
It sounds like experts are no good in this.
Well, I mean, it's not clear. It's just not clearly defined
They don't accept experts in the forestry field as in relationship to their determination of what's good forest land or not forest land. So
one thing DLCD doesn't do, or LCDC, is not another aspect of the problem, the gap, is that Dutch fir and ponderosa pine and other commercial trees, cedar, produce at different rates. And what might at 50 cubic feet a year for ponderosa pine might be a commercial forest. But 30 feet or 20 feet for a cedar or a ponderosa might be very productive for that particular species, and they don't distinguish at the state level. They just give you a number.
That's
problematic.
It's in the works. According to the state, they're pushing for ODF to really take a stand. And that's kind of DLC's stance, too, is it's not called out by ODF. ODF has yet to kind of put their foot down and kind of give some guidelines. What is it? So my understanding from talking to DLCD is they're anticipating something coming. Right now there's nothing, and each individual county kind of has their own definition right now, and they're okay with that.
But what's ironic is ODF is the one that put their blessing on our IRR system and said it was the best system they'd ever seen.
Yeah.
And now they're taking that and saying that's no good, but now we're going to take those same experts and use them over here because it's going to fit what we want. I mean, it's Jack and then Malcolm and then Peggy.
We created a subcommittee and we put Jim Frick on it. Lots of contact with Swanson and Petra and whatever. We could get some meaningful input with the people involved in doing this commercially, given north slope, south slope, serpentine, whatever have you, probably make a reasonable recommendation.
I think I'll send an email to Jim and indicate that he's been selected to be the lead on the task force.
I think that would be appropriate.
I second that.
Jim does have a biology background.
Yeah, he does.
So. Well, but is that just a futile exercise? If the state is going to require ODF to come up with some standards, are they just going to then turn around and say, well, we've got the ODF standards now, and that's what we're going to apply everywhere? I mean, are they going to allow them?
They probably will at some point, but you know, the way the state moves, that might not happen for another year, 2 years, 3 years. In the meantime, what Bob's pointing at, and I agree, is that the IRR system's been called out, and it's not consistent with the, you got to apply these state laws and rules directly. We've been doing that. Problem is there is no definitive threshold, what's commercial, what's not. The rules dance around, point, and in different circumstances, what they're looking for is higher quality, but don't come out and specifically say that. So given the fact that we've never had to do that until now, we don't have anything on the books that say in Josephine County, here's commercial, here's not. So far, 20's been safe, only because really nobody's gone beyond it. Actually, Bob's the only one been doing zone changes right now, and they've all kind of met that less than 20 threshold. It was safe. It kind of fit in with what I can find in the rules. And what's going on in Jackson County, they're somewhat similar, more so than Douglas, so it was a safe way. And nobody's called us on that yet in terms of any opposition. Just Bob.
Bob and
Stone. Bob might have one that's got 50. Bob's got one that's got 50 coming. That's what's going on.
So, Malcolm, you said that LCDC or somebody's going to come out with some standards, you think, in the future about whether soils are commercial forests or not. But we have the added twist that we've got woodlot resources and forest commercial.
They got that all around, though.
So that's, they will be addressed in both of them.
That's still a forest. It's still a forest.
Resources doesn't necessarily have to be the top grade cash cows of the forest. You know, I mean, that's part
no.
Of
and typically they're not. They're kind of the secondary forest land.
As long as it's a green tree.
Yeah, doesn't that matter if it's a drone or an oak?
That was a statement made back in 1982-83. If it's a green tree, it's a resource. If there's green trees, it's safe. It's a green
who
forest.
Who said that?
Mel Hunt.
Huh?
Mel Hunt.
Yes.
Well, you said Hal Anthony and those
no. Oh, they weren't even born then. They didn't even what, they couldn't even spell Andy's at that point. Okay, so I'll get in touch with Mr. Frick and advise him to maybe touch base with you and work on this and bring back a report to us. Anything else? Anybody have any other? Just an update on 3615. I was at a meeting over in Jackson County, and it looks like the Jackson County is going to try to pursue asking for DLCD or LCDC to move forward in trying to implement 3615, which they can under their existing rules, from what they believe, and try to do it before the next legislative session, if in fact they'll take it up or not. If not, they're preparing to go with some more language or come up with another bill that would be addressed or brought in on the February 2012 legislative session.
So is the issue with the legislature just that they didn't pass the funding for?
No. It was a political move by the Senate president, who had a certain interest in a marine bill that was, I guess, authored by the Thousand Friends of Oregon, which was going to be more restrictive over on the coast for fishing. And the Republicans wouldn't let that move forward, and so he was holding this one hostage. Because they wouldn't let his bill that he wanted to have happen, so it just died. And the issue of DLCD would, of course, is going to, of course, be the funding part. They have no money, and so I don't know how they're going to address it. But I do know that Jackson County is going to pursue it to some degree at this point in time. The other thing is Jackson County just passed their regional problem solving.
Oh, finally. 10 years.
10 years, which is an expedited process. It was a 3-2 vote.
Three to two.
And if tried to get it to go before the commissioners with no recommendation, because not everybody was happy with the process at all or any of the final results out of it. So it's going to get interesting.
One more little question. Did anyone get, I noticed in the paper they were advertising for John Renzo's job. Was anyone ever hired?
They just keep bringing the guy down from Eugene. I think he's a regional guy.
Ed Moore.
Yeah.
They've narrowed it down to four candidates.
Regional representative from
David sat on the panel.
If you'd like me to answer that, I can. Yeah. I sat on the interview panel the other day for four candidates that we interviewed. I don't know if a job offer's been made to any of them yet. Had a couple of good folks out of that group. But there was good representation from all the local jurisdictions. All three counties were there. That was Jackson and Josephine, as well as Central Point, Grants Pass, Medford, and Ashland.
Great.
And so process was pretty good. We'll see what the outcome might be. And, go from there, but it would be nice to have somebody of the top candidates. They all express a desire to work with local governments as a liaison, kind of a two-way street, not just top-down, this is the state, this is what we say.
Yeah,
so, perspective is kind of refreshing to see, but that's also something trying to get a job.
One other quick piece of information is separate from this, but it's called, the city slickers get millions in farm subsidies, and this is from the year 1996 to 2000. And there's a total of 52,200 recipients that live inside cities that are receiving farm subsidy to the tune of $536,357,283. Portland is the only Oregon big city that they're showing, and Portland has 971 recipients receiving $14,456,427 in farm subsidies between the year 1996 and 2000.
Well, are they farms in the city, or are they...
Apparently. I didn't realize that. It's that community farming deal.
First they got the subsidies, and then they reconverted them and built farms.
Yeah.
Hey, I've got a couple of raised beds in my backyard.
You got it. You're on.
Well, about you know they live in the city because they're not allowed to live on the farm.
That's true.
The
yeah. Yeah.
There was a short news thing on the Cajo site that said the $4.5 million that was scrubbed from the 199 project is now going to Talent. Has anybody heard anything about that?
I'm not sure that article was accurate, because I was over in Medford. I was talking to Mike Montero, who's the chairman on that, and he said that they found additional monies to take care of the 199 in Phoenix that wasn't any part of the 4.1 or whatever that was, 4.9. So
since you want to
start saying the curtain, that's something wrong.
Oh, no. Heavens, no.
This was Cajo. This was not the curtain.
Yeah, and it was in the paper, too. It was in the Mail Tribune, too. So, anything else? If not, we're going to meet on August. Yeah.
Next week, right?
Yeah, there we go. August 8th.
August 8th.
Yeah. Thank you very much, folks.
Appreciate it.